Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
And in this edition of Africa Link, Kenya's Deputy President William Ruto defends himself as he waits to hear whether or not he has a case to answer at the ICC.
I firmly believe in my innocence. Circumstances surrounding this matter, post-election violence, victims of a syndicate of falsehood and a conspiracy of lies that are obviously against truth and justice.
And remember last year's Fees Must Fall demonstrations in South Africa? They are back again.
We are here today at VETS saying that each and every academically deserving student is allowed to register at the university with or without the money.
Plus, how Ghana's hipsters of nature are helping protect their environment. Good morning and thanks for tuning to Africa Link. I'm Crispin Wekideu in Bonn.
Top story.
There's a saying that goes, the wheels of justice grind slowly but exceedingly fine. It's nearly 5 years ago when Kenya's Deputy President William Ruto alongside five other suspects were indicted by the ICC. They were accused of orchestrating the 2007 and 8 post-election violence. Four of these suspects, including Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta, have since been acquitted. Ruto and his co-defendant, radio presenter Joshua Arap Sang, are now back in The Hague to find out whether or not they have a case to answer. James Shimanyula has more on the story.
Kenya's Deputy President William Ruto and his co-defendant, vernacular radio talk show host Joshua Arap Sang, have consistently denied orchestrating the human atrocities that were triggered by the 2007 disputed presidential election. Ruto says he believes it is only a matter of time that charges against him are dropped.
I firmly believe in my innocence. Circumstances surrounding this matter, post-election violence, victims of a syndicate of falsehood and a conspiracy of lies that are obviously against truth and justice.
Ruto's conviction of his own innocence is backed by one of his lawyers, Karim Khan. The British lawyer specializing in international human rights law has criticized the way the case has been run so far.
The prosecution investigation has been a parody of justice, and unfortunately, it can only be described as a whole-scale duping of an office that has been put in place to protect the rights of victims.
Resumption of Ruto's case at The Hague will compel his lawyer Karim Khan to make submissions revolving around the no case to answer motions. Aden Duale, leader of the Jubilee coalition in Kenya's parliament and a fierce critic of the ICC, also weighed in on the significance of Ruto's appearance at the ICC.
Our defense team will have 4 days to argue on no case to answer. We want to tell the ICC judges that we ought not to have been in The Hague. The case was based on falsehood. The case was built on politics. And we want to prove beyond reasonable doubt that one William Samoei Ruto and Joshua Arap Sang are victims of local political falsehood.
Such criticism has not escaped the attention of the ICC. However, Chile Eboe Osuji, presiding judge in the Ruto Sang case, urged fellow judges not to let such talk get to them.
Our attention has been drawn to the unending stream of clamor in the Kenyan media about the proceedings in this case. Even abusive commentaries have been directed at the court and the judges. When judicial decisions have been issued that has not been or have not been to the liking of those making those commentaries.
Eric Mutua, chairman of the Law Society of Kenya, explains why the Ruto Sang case should end as soon as possible.
It is important now that we have a determination one way or another of those cases, because these cases are affecting even the way we do our politics in Kenya. They are affecting the social transformation negatively.
As Ruto's case resumes in The Hague, Kenyans have expressed varying opinions.
If there's no evidence, they can just leave it.
It has turned political, so we just need peace among our people. We have to get who killed the innocent Kenyans.
And that report was compiled by James Shimanyula in Nairobi. One of the persons who has been closely following the Kenyan case at The Hague is Elizabeth Evanson. She's a senior counsel in the International Justice Programme at Human Rights Watch in Brussels. I asked her to explain in simple terms what the no case to answer motion means.
Sure. Well, a no case to answer motion, it's actually the first time that this is being used at the International Criminal Court, but something similar has been used at other international tribunals. And what it really means is it's sort of the halftime of the trial. So the prosecution has presented its case against Deputy President Ruto, against Joshua Tseng. And the defense have asked the judges to find that the prosecution simply hasn't presented enough evidence such that they need to put on their own case now, and that the case should just be ended now. So they're basically saying that no matter what kind of weight is given to the prosecution's evidence in the final counting up by the judges, there's just not enough there to convict and not enough there as a result for the defense to be forced to go through and put on their own case, and that the case should just be ended at this point.
Apart from the motion of no case to answer, the ICC Appeals Chamber will also rule on whether the court's chief prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda, can rely on prior recorded testimony. How crucial is this evidence to Ruto's case?
The trial chamber has already accepted into evidence the prior recorded testimony of four or five witnesses, four of whom testified in court, but then recanted, took back some of the critical aspects of their testimony, one other witness who didn't show up for court. The trial chamber's decision to allow that evidence into testimony is what's up on appeal. The appeals chamber is looking at it to see whether it was a proper application of the rule that allows this kind of evidence to come before the trial chamber.
And what are the chances that the ICC will drop the charges against Ruto like it did to President Uhuru Kenyatta?
Well, we're at two different points in time. So the decision by the ICC prosecutor to withdraw charges against President Kenyatta, and that decision then was ultimately confirmed by the court's judges, that was taken before the start of trial. That was based on two witnesses. That was based on the prosecutor's decision that she could no longer rely on some very important witnesses. It was also based on, as she termed it, the government's non-cooperation and coming forward with information based on a number of other factors. Here, this is something now for the judges to consider. The prosecution here has said it's put forward enough evidence such that the defense do need to mount a case, and that the trial needs to run to the end, and the judges will need to weigh up all the evidence. It's impossible to predict, or it's impossible to say. We just have to wait and see. It's a decision that only the judges can make.
But then doesn't it also reflect on the court's credibility if indeed it fails to convict or find Ruto guilty? Doesn't it damage the court's credibility?
I don't know if it damages the court's credibility, because it's very important that the notion of justice include the possibility of there being acquittals at the end of the day. You know, if the wrong people have been brought before the court and the judges find that there's not sufficient evidence, if that's the outcome of a fair process, that should still be considered to be the ICC doing what it was set up to do. But the outcome of a particular case before the court needs to be judged, I think, on whether the process itself has been credible and whether it's led to a fair result. And sometimes that credible and fair result may look like a conviction, and sometimes it may look like an acquittal.
Senior counsel at the International Justice Programme of Human Rights Watch, Elizabeth Evanson. And when we return, we are still in Kenya, but this time with some good news.
Get the stories that are shaping the continent here on Africa Link.
It's back to school at Garissa University College. The Kenyan Learning Institution reopened on Monday after 9 months of closure. Al-Shabaab gunmen stormed the campus then and killed 148 people, most of them students. Security has been beefed up with a police post stationed inside the college. An IT firm on Monday also donated a biometric scanner which keeps records of all those who enter the university compound. Andrew Wasike reports.
Garissa University resumed teachings Monday, 9 months after gunmen stormed the university in the northern Kenya, killing 142 students and injuring more than 80 others. The school, which is located some 200 kilometers from the Kenya-Somali border, was closed down after the attack. Kenyans are divided on whether the school should reopen or stay closed and be turned to a memorial center for the innocent lives lost. A student, Mariam Sakida, noted that the only way to stop terrorism was through education.
Kujisajili kwetu hapa ni kutuma ujumbe.
By coming back to Garissa University to register as students, we are sending a message that even if there is terrorism or other problems in Garissa, we are residents of Garissa and we are not leaving. If there is a school located here, then we will come and study. Others say that you can kill a terrorist using a bullet, but the only way to put an end to terrorism is through education.
The school has been renovated to hide all the bullet holes that littered the walls. The Elgon View hostels where the gunmen stood while shooting at students has received a name change and is now the Ewasongiro hostels. This has been done to hide a sad past. William Musila, one of the students who attended classes on Monday, said he was happy to be back at Garissa University.
Before that, we were very happy. We were continuing our studies very well. We had dreams that we were going to complete our course very soon. But whatever happened did not make us give up. I'm very happy that the university has come up now with more strength than it was previously. And we hope that more students will come. The continuing students are very happy because they have their chances now to complete their course.
However, Bansi Wahome said she struggled to convince her family to get back to the university to finish her course.
My sisters were very much against. My brother was asking, is there no other place you'd have chosen to go? And I'm like, if it's a matter of security, there is no way we can say it's secure. Give myself hope is that nowhere is safe. Any place I am, only guns guarantees safety.
Despite the fear and trauma among the students of Garissa University, the government has heightened the security with over 30 police officers stationed inside the university. Last year's attack on the Kenyan University was the deadliest that Kenya has witnessed in 2 decades.
Andrew Wasike reporting.
Africa on the move.
Taking care of the environment can actually be fun. Just ask Ghana's Hipsters of Nature. This is a group of young people dedicated to bringing back Ghana's natural beauty. They aim to accomplish this by engaging in artistic events and projects that promote recycling and afforestation. This Africa on the Move report by Hilke Fisher is now presented by Privilege Mushaniri.
With over 2 million residents, Accra is littered with garbage to the dismay of many. Drainage channels filled with garbage are a common feature in Ghana's capital city. Due to drainage blockage, flooding is a widespread occurrence during the rain season. Many people drown, and in some instances, this has resulted in death. It smells, it is annoying, and it is dangerous, says Beatrice Dosa. The Ghanaian is disgusted to see her hometown littered with garbage. Beatrice looks on with concern as the blocked drainage system fills up with waste. Like a fellow resident, she is worried that it could happen again.
If we don't stop this attitude of throwing waste around anyhow and not finding a proper way of managing it, more people are going to be affected by the floods. We don't want anybody to die from flooding again.
3 years ago, Beatrice launched Hipsters of Nature, an environmental protection group. The members meet on a regular basis to search for creative and inexpensive ways to win people over for environmental protection. The activist group is targeting the young generation to change people's attitude towards irresponsible dumping of garbage. They are also teaching about environmental conservation, and one little girl, Memuna Ibrahim, got their message clearly.
They taught us that we should keep our environment clean. And when we don't keep our environment clean, someone of us can get sick and die.
Hipsters of Nature spread their message through various ways, including shows where they showcase things made out of garbage. The aim is to have fun while learning serious matters, Beatrice explains.
We have hope in the children because they are ready to learn. And when we empower them, they will be like the ambassadors and spread the message out there.
Hipsters of Nature often organize creative projects. So far, they have created a gigantic bottle made of wire. These are put up in large squares of the capital as a waste container for plastic bottles. The bottle-shaped container is 3 meters tall. that is about 10 feet. This makes it easy for people to see it. The group do not get paid for the work they do. They depend on well-wishers. One of them is Helen List. The Australian operates a beach hotel in Accra. A team of cleaners go out daily to pick up the garbage on the beach.
Makes it difficult for my guests to come here and swim. It's not a great view anymore from the restaurant or any of the facilities in the hotel, so it does impact on my business quite negatively, I think.
Now Beatrice and Helen plan to team up to win over the authorities for their fight against the growing tide of waste.
And that report was written by Hilke Fischer. The South African government on Monday said it has set aside 10 billion rands for the National Student Financial Aid Scheme. The move comes amid a new wave of fees must fall protests at the Witwatersrand University in Johannesburg. Similar demonstrations last year nearly brought tyre lining in South Africa to a standstill. Tuzo Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
Protesting students occupied the wall where registration was to take place at Witwatersrand University on Monday, demanding registration of all academically qualified students, whether they had money to pay or not. They allege that the current university fees that go as high as $2,500 per year in some universities is a system of financial exclusion for black students who most come from poor families. Protesting student Kodani Mutumuli Mutapuli, who is pursuing a degree in business studies, says access to education must never be based on one's ability to pay.
We are here today at VETS saying that each and every academically deserving student is allowed to register at the university with or without the money. You know, we're talking about the future of South Africa. That is why we're saying free education should happen in our lifetime, not 20 years later, not 10 years later, but in our lifetime.
Lengwe Ndlovu, who is studying for a PhD in sociology, says they do not want payment arrangement or student loans, but free education.
A lot of the students are still stuck at home. They can't come here. They don't have money. They don't even have money to register. We are few in numbers right now. We are determined to stay here. We are determined to occupy particularly this space, Solomon House, until the management do something about this situation.
They also want a total scrapping of registration fees, currently at over $500. They are also demanding that students who still owe the university must be given access to their academic records despite having not paid. The protest, however, left hundreds of parents who had come to register their children stranded. Busisiwe Dalisa had come to the university to register her son for a nursing degree.
I am upset, very much upset, because really, we don't know what to do, to go or to stay, or very much upsetting, Shem.
And her son, Letukutula Blessings Lalisa, was also angered by the situation he got during his first day at the university.
I am not happy at all, because I came here very early in the morning. So I thought by now I'll be going back home with everything done. So I still have to come back here again tomorrow, maybe the other day also, because they have not confirmed anything.
But protesting students say it is better to inconvenience a few now to attain a permanent convenience for all.
DW correspondent Tuzo Kumalo reporting in Johannesburg.
Making a difference.
In our Making a Difference story for this week, we meet a 28-year-old Zimbabwean who is helping children living with HIV. Kelvin Mutize is a volunteer leader for a program which fights against discrimination of HIV-positive children in Southern Africa region, as well as Kenya and Uganda. Our correspondent in Zimbabwe, Columbus Mavunga, caught up with him in Harare and filed this report.
Kelvin Mutize works with the program Champions for Life, which supports HIV-positive children between the ages of 10 and 24 in the Southern African region, as well as in Kenya and Uganda. Mutize has set up the program in 9 countries, traveling around at his own expense as a volunteer. The goal is to educate HIV-positive youths about the need to behave responsibly and to ensure that they do not feel alienated because of the virus.
After the hospital has done all its work with the hospitals and the pills, we come into the social aspect that, yes, as much as you're taking medication, there are also social factors, home factors that children struggle with, you know, like extended families, childhood families, you know, staying with your stepmom, staying with your stepfather, or you're staying with your grandmother and their challenges. So what we do is we try to work out from the inside out. At the end of the day, what you see on the outside is a kid failing to take medicine. But on the inside, the kid is struggling, psychosocially struggling. Maybe he's got challenges struggling, adjusting from losses of the parents or anything like that. So that's what we try to do, work on their attitude, work on who they are from the inside out.
Kevin Mutize says they organize workshops and send counselors to deal with cases like these. Champions for Life aims to support around 1,000 children in each of the countries it works in. Mutize recently won an award for his efforts at the Future Awards Africa under the Prize in Community Action category. The World Bank and Forbes sponsored the award, which is also known as the Nobel Prize for Young Africans. But Mutize says there is still a lot of work to do.
Ending HIV/AIDS in Africa is a big challenge. It's not just the parents, but it's also us, the teens as well. It's also us, the youth. It's going to take a resolve amongst the whole continent to say, let's stop HIV and AIDS, because it's not going to stop. It's not going away. At one point, people thought, because infection from mother to child is significantly dropped, that's the most amazing thing, that in the next 5 to 10 years, we might not be even getting children being born with HIV and AIDS, especially if you're going through the medical system in Africa. But then we still now we're seeing a rise within the youth of HIV/AIDS virus.
The continent has its work cut out for it when it comes to tackling HIV and AIDS. The United Nations Population Fund recently told DW that Africa had low supplies of condoms, which are necessary to stop the transmission of HIV and STIs among sexual partners. That is not all, as the head of Doctors Without Borders Pharmacy in Southern Africa, Tiny Gills, explains.
So we want to put everyone who's positive on ART, and we're going to have to make sure that the medicines reach the patients. One of the major problems that we have seen is that actually already at this moment, when we're still only reaching half of who we want to reach, medicines often don't reach patients. So we see a lot of stockouts, which means that ARVs are not available in the clinic when the patients need them across the region of Southern Africa.
It is these African patients who are not getting medication, especially the young ones, that Mutize and his Champions for Life are trying to help. With the hard work of volunteer leaders like Mutize, the program provides these children with comfort and reassurance that they are not alone.
Columbus Mavunga reporting in Harare.
For more about Africa Link, go to dw.com/AfricaLink. Find out about Africa Link's partner stations. Send us your feedback in a text message and sign up for our newsletter, dw.com/AfricaLink.
And as always, here's now a summary of our main stories. Kenya's Deputy President William Ruto is appearing at the International Criminal Court to hear whether or not he has a case to answer. Garissa University College in Kenya has reopened 9 months after Al-Shabaab militants killed 148 people. And South Africa has set aside 10 billion rands for higher learning amid new wave of fees must fall protests. And that's all we had for you in this edition of Africa Link. To send us your comments and suggestions on the program, either via text message to country code 491609575910, an email to feedback.africa@dw.com, or a letter to Africa Link, DW 53110, Bonn, Germany. From me, Crispin Mwakideu, have a good day.